Welcome. Steve Ose is with us today from Olympia, Washington. He's the director of the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, or WISIP. The Institute's mission is to carry out practical, nonpartisan research at the direction of the state legislature on issues of importance to Washington State. The product of WISIP's work is often cost-benefit analysis that helps the legislature understand which policy options are likely to be the most cost-effective. WISIP has worked in policy areas such as education, criminal justice, welfare, children and adult services, health, and more. In recognition of its work, the Pew Charitable Trusts is currently funding 12 states around the nation to strengthen their capacity to do cost-benefit analysis along the lines of WISIP. Steve, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome, Andy. It's great to be here.
So start us off with some history of how WISIP started and how it's developed.
What we've become known for, what you just listed there in terms of evidence-based public policy making, really began in the 1990s for WISIP. We, like most states, I think there was a spike in juvenile arrest rates, especially for violent crime about that time in the late 80s and the early 90s. And so this state, like most states, tried to respond in a number of ways. We had just finished evaluating one little pilot project that was done in our state on juvenile justice, and we found out that it wasn't working. We had a near random assignment, quasi-experimental assignment of an evaluation of a pilot program. We found out that this intensive supervision program wasn't working. Mm-hmm. And so when we came out with that finding, and I think it was 95 or so, the legislature responded and said, well, Institute, thanks for that finding, but now tell us what works. Mm-hmm. And so at that point is when we first began our inquiry into doing what I think of as investment analysis 101. We, like any private investment advisor, what we sought to do for our legislature is we went around and looked at the most rigorous research that we could find anywhere in the country or the rest of the world on what has been done successfully and demonstrated through rigorous research to reduce juvenile crime rates. Mm-hmm. And we found a number of things that looked promising, that if we brought them into Washington State, they would be better than average bets that they would reduce crime. And we found a number of things that looked promising, that if we brought them into Washington State, they would be better than average bets that they would reduce crime. And I'm an economist, and so my natural tendency is not just to accept something that reduces, but I also want to know where's the return on investment. Because some things, you might be able to reduce crime, but it would cost an arm and a leg and wouldn't be worth it. So we began to not only say what works, but we then said what's economic as well, the sort of the second of the two questions that we address for whatever we look at. So we built a cost-benefit model at that time to start to look in a systematic way at not only what reduces juvenile crime that we might be able to take advantage of in Washington, but where do taxpayers get the best return on their investment. And so we got that information back to the legislature in the late 90s. They took it. They took our advice. That's why they created us. They took our advice then, and we began to craft budgets, juvenile justice budgets in the state, and implement the programs that were on our buy list, if you want to think about that in an investment kind of a way. And so the juvenile justice system at that point began to be transformed into an evidence-based system that required that there be sufficient evidence and economics to say that this is the way we're going to fund programs. But that was going well. And so then in the late 90s, the legislature said in bills direct to the Institute, said, well, let's now take a look at the adult correction system now that we've started to reform the juvenile justice system. And so we began to get assignments from our legislature to look at what works and what's economic in the adult correction system. And so that system then began to be reformed in the late 90s and the early 2000s. And at that time, then, a couple other legislators wrote bills, sent to the Institute, said, well, let's take a look at early age prevention programs. Rather than waiting for crime to happen, why don't we see if we can do something that's evidence-based and economics-based in the early childhood education and other prevention areas. So we began to do that. And one area after another, state government, we could go on with this list that's gone on into then in K-12 education and then into mental health and substance abuse and child welfare, particularly in some other areas that we're now working in as well. One after another, we've beginning to expand the use of the information, making it available, and legislators and key staff on the legislative budget writing committees have been using that information to help reform, at least in part, some of the way things are done in Washington State.
So, Steve, to recap, the legislature asks WSSIP to investigate a question. The staff look at what research is available, and also there's some sense of what research is credible. And you, in a way, aggregate the findings of that research to produce advice on what different options would be more cost-effective than others. Is that a valid way to summarize?
Yeah, that's the broad brush of it. I think the key thing there, Andy, is that we don't have an agenda of our own. We're governed by a board of directors, a 16-member board of directors, hire me as the director, and then I hire the staff that we have here. And the board has 10 of the members are in the legislative branch of government. There are eight members of the legislature, 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans, equally divided between the House and the Senate. So members get on the Institute's board, legislative members, knowing that it's meant to be a nonpartisan work group, and it's run that way. They have co-chairs. We always have a Democrat and a Republican co-chair, one from the House and the Senate, and that rotates around. The two nonpartisan staff directors, the committee staff directors, who are also on our board of directors, so we have 10 of the 16 members are from the legislative branch of government. The governor appoints 2 members to our board, usually the state budget director and usually the agency head of one of the major agencies in the states on our board. And then there are 4 representatives from the public higher education institutions in the state, and that rounds out our 16 members board. But the critical thing is that I think is that all of the assignments that we undertake here come to us, or 99% of them, come to us because the legislature writes a bill. Our legislature's in session right now, and they're writing bills. I've got a list of them sitting here on my desk of proposed provisos that will end up in the state budget that direct studies to the Institute. I think this is a very important part of how the Institute operates. We don't just start a study on juvenile justice. The legislature says to us in a bill that passes both houses and gets signed by the governor, it says, we want the Institute to produce a study on juvenile justice or K-12 class size or child welfare or whatever the topic is, and we want them to report back to us by such and such a date with its findings. And so it's a clear statement that the legislature wants the information. They expect it to be produced in a nonpartisan way. We do all that stuff that we just talked about substantively, looking at rigorous evidence, using strict definitions of what rigor means and economics. But that the whole process is set up to now integrate that kind of that approach. And it's, you know, right now we're in the middle of a legislative session, so it's all more, even more real than it is when they're not in session. That individual staff members of the committee will call up and say, some member has an idea that they want to know more about adult mental health. What should we do? And I mean, and so then we craft some language that would set up a study that would allow us to answer that question there. And then that goes to the member. And if the member can get fellow members to put it in the budget, that's how studies get generated in this way. So it's that whole process of putting the numbers in, having other people, not just those of us at the Institute, want the information. That's what I think of as the important cultural aspect of a state capitol where decisions are made. And the conditions that need to go along with making anything ultimately happen. It's one thing just to produce the numbers. I love it. You know, when we get those assignments, we go into our number production mode. We do our research here. But those studies would just sit on the shelf if there wasn't also that cultural interest at this stage, in Olympia at least, to ask for the information, to want the information, to expect the information to be produced, and then to have it generated into policy proposals often in the coming legislative sessions.
Steve, I want to conclude by asking you for some of your lessons that you think we can learn from WSSIP for other states and localities that are trying to boost their capacity to do evidence-based policy and to do cost-effectiveness analysis. I think it's important to note that as WSSIP is being replicated in other places, it does take on different forms. For example, New York State right now is boosting their capacity to do cost-benefit analysis. It's a process that's connected strongly to the governor's office. In other places, like in New Mexico, they are strengthening that capacity tied to the legislature, just like it is in your state. So it can take different forms, but more broadly, what do you think are some of the lessons that other places could learn from WSSIP?
Well, to your first point there, I think where this belongs in any given state depends on the culture of decision making in those states. It's going to be, I think it's different from state to state. So I've had a chance to visit a lot of the states just because they've been interested in what WSIP has done, what's gone on in Washington. So I've talked to a lot of people in a lot of the states. Washington has a very strong legislative branch. The governor by law submits a budget, proposed budget in the fall, but really the legislature writes a budget. It's writing the budget right now. The Senate budget was released earlier last Friday, and the House budget's coming out, and they're very different than the governor's budgets. And so this is a strong legislative state, I would say, relative to the executive branch. Having the institute in the legislative branch of government makes all great sense. It may belong in a different place, in a different different culture of decision making in different states, where maybe the balance of those separation of powers is different. It could be in a single purpose area. Some states have tried to take this approach and put it in their criminal justice, because that's what we did first. I mean, that was our first outcome. And so some states have taken this approach and just put it in a criminal justice agency. I tend to advise against that. I think that this type of approach works better when it's in a general purpose governmental unit, like the Institute or maybe a governor's budget office, somebody that sees across those budgetary silos. If you just have it in a criminal justice agency, there's a danger that you'll do all the work there, and then that institute, whatever it is, will just become known as the criminal justice people. You really want to have the approach that cuts across all the lines, that cuts across those budget silos, and focuses on the outcome, whatever that may be. So that's why I encourage whatever state's doing it to try to put it in a broader area, whether it's in the executive branch or the legislative branch. I also think that it's important for it to be seen, maybe especially in these days, as a nonpartisan, not only to be seen as, but to be a nonpartisan entity. And that's probably easier to do in the legislative branch, because you can set it up that way to be governed by both parties. If it's in the governor's office, it's going to be in one party or another, and may have more difficulty as administrations change for surviving. So I think in our case, it's been particularly well suited here in Washington because of the strong legislature and because it was set up as it to be nonpartisan. And then I might add, perhaps the most important thing is that you have some key legislators along the way in key positions within the legislature that want to use this stuff, that understand why you want to have evidence, that understand why you have economics applied to it, that have an appreciation for it. We've had a couple of very important members in various committees of both parties that have been chairs or ranking members that have really wanted this information, that have pushed it. None of this, I think, would have gone very far without those key members.
Champions.
Probably most states have them. If you don't have any, then it's probably not going to happen right away. And they need to be in a pretty influential position, usually speakers or at least committee chairs, those kinds of things.
Steve, thank you very much for joining us. And congratulations to you and your board and your staff and the Washington legislature for creating what's really a national model in terms of increasing state capacity to do evidence-based policy and cost-effective policy. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me, Andy.